It's just about a minute and a half this side of the 8 o'clock hour, and Wednesday brings us Laureen Gilbert. Laureen Gilbert is the president and CEO, the award-winning president and CEO of WealthWise Financial Services. This is the WealthWise moment. Welcome, Laureen.
Good morning, Ed. Thank you.
How are you today?
I'm wonderful.
Well, after knowing that, and you've told me this before, you've told our audience this before, but you enjoy the most delicious beverage in the morning, more the delicious than even my coffee that I've been. Tell us your routine in the morning. What beverage is that?
Well, I get the green tea matcha from our Laguna Beach Farmers Market and put a plug in for the Zen tea there. And I use that, and I make my green tea matcha latte with my homemade almond milk and put that in the frother, and it's delicious. Along with, let me also say, the honey that comes from our farmer's market as well.
Oh, yeah. You know, we get some fabulous stuff from the farmer's market, and I think I see you more there than I do anywhere else in town. But yeah, there are some fabulous stands and some little undiscovered nooks and crannies of the farmer's market. Your tea and honey supply are just a couple of them. So, yeah,
there you go.
Sounds delicious. Some important stuff has happened, of course, in the past week since we spoke last. The Colonial Pipeline hack. Stocks were affected immediately following it. Now I'm talking to friends back east. They're looking at what they're calling end of world type of shortages and lines at gas stations already. Talk about the implications to consumers and to investors about this latest hack.
Right. So the Colonial Pipeline is a critical part of our infrastructure in America, carrying about 3 million barrels of fuel a day, over 5,500 miles when you look at from Texas to New York. So it definitely, it impacts the East Coast much more so than the West Coast. And if we look at what's happened since this attack happened, you can see that gas prices have risen. You can see that consumers have been rushing to the pumps. And it's also, if you look at the numbers, it's affected the East Coast much more than it has the West Coast. So it's an important part, like I said, of infrastructure. And unfortunately, this idea of cyber attacks is something that we know about. Certainly, traded companies are very concerned about it. It's talked about in the boardroom of every board meeting that is held now. You know, how can companies protect themselves? And so it's certainly been something that we know about, could always happen, and it shows our vulnerability to our overall infrastructure when something happens like this.
So when should investors now look at companies that they are considering investing in and go, well, are they vulnerable? And will that be part of the decision-making process for them?
Well, I think it's certainly something that investors should be questioning. It should be part of the discussion. And I think that you hear that oftentimes when you hear about, as we go through earnings season and we listen to earnings calls with companies, it's something that companies definitely address. So from a consumer or is it from an investor standpoint, it certainly is part of an investment decision to make sure that the companies that they're looking at have plans in place. And here's what anybody will tell you on the security side. It's not a matter of when or if it's going to happen, it's a matter of when.
Right.
So it's not a question of if it will happen to a company. It's a matter of when it will happen. What are the security measures in place? And I think then it comes to, from an investment standpoint, looking as well as what are the companies that are in the forefront of cybersecurity and looking at who those companies are, who's going to be a winner in that space.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. From March to April, and I something drove me crazy that I heard yesterday, we had a 0.8% jump in inflation from March to April, which was the fastest since 2008. It's now considered to be a 4.9% annual rate, I guess. But I heard someone say yesterday that this is like the late 70s. And really, in the late 70s, we know that there was somewhere between 11, 12, 13, and even 15% inflation in 1980. Explain, please, how this is different from then and even different from 2008.
So, it brings up this issue of inflation. What is going on? And are we in a reflation environment or an inflation environment? And what's the difference?
Right.
So let's talk about that.
Thank you.
There is a difference between reflation and inflation, and it has to do with the growth rate. When you have a high growth rate like we do right now and a lower inflation rate like we do now, that's considered a reflationary environment. Inflation, true just straight inflation, is a lower growth rate and a higher inflation rate. So it has to do with the differences between the growth rate and the inflation rate. So back to what you were saying, yes, we are seeing inflation accelerate at a level that we haven't seen in over a decade. So over the last decade, we have had a sub 2% inflation rate consistently in our economy. And now what we're looking at, Ed, is an inflation rate that is above 2%. My estimate is around 2.5% per year over the next decade. So what's the difference? It sounds like, wow, that doesn't sound that big, but it is a huge jump, and the acceleration that we're seeing is real. So I would say in all of that, what does that now mean? It means that from an investment standpoint, we need to factor in a much higher inflation rate than we have in the last 10 years. It means a lot of things for people as they're coming to retirement. It means quite a bit to investors as they're thinking about what areas of the market should they add to their portfolios to protect them against inflation that is real and here to stay. And the other point that I'll make is that the stimulus that we've seen, much of the stimulus that we've seen until now, has been meant to enter into the economy quickly. And that means where we're seeing this immediate spike up, that a big spike in inflation. However, the latest plans that have been proposed, when you look at the numbers, are putting money into the economy over the next decade, which is why I see that number being sustainable at around that 2.5% mark, because the money that is expected to go in is expected to continue to go in year after year after year for the next decade.
Okay. And is there a red line that you see where the Fed would eventually jump in?
Well, absolutely. And that's why you saw the markets move when Yellen made that comment last week. The markets reacted. And of course, it's not Yellen in Treasury that's going to impact the rates. It's Powell on the Federal Reserve side that's going to make that decision. But eventually, we know that the Fed has to increase rates. However, they have been staying the course with keeping rates low. I would like to get back into this idea, Ed, about, what does this mean for investors now? All of what we've just talked about has many implications for investors, and what can they do now? We're just coming off of the best earnings season that we've seen since 2008, and just a fantastic earnings season with 86% of S&P 500 reporting a positive earnings per share surprise. That is the highest we've seen since 2008. So now, with inflation on the rise, accelerating at a faster pace, where can investors go and what should investors do? Because a lot of investors are saying to me, look, we've seen over the last year the markets go up substantially. What does that mean? Have we missed out, or is this all there is? And what I will say is we see more to come. And the reason for that is, like I said, we still see money flowing from a stimulus perspective into the market. We still expect GDP to have this 6-8% this year, and then continue to be in high growth rates into 2022. So I would say that I think a lot of investors are going to miss this next run up. Right now, we're taking a little breather in the markets. That's normal and natural, but we are early in the recovery. We are still very early. So what that means is there's still opportunities in equities. And when we look at inflation, areas to be thinking about, small cap stocks, when we look at stocks, small cap stocks are the best outperformer over inflation. So thinking about increasing and overweighting when it comes to small stocks. Also, we're on a longer dollar decline. That means that overweighting emerging markets is a good place. And then your classic inflation hedges, like commodities, tips, those areas. And then let's not forget that also value tends to do better than growth in an inflationary environment. So some of those same themes that I've been talking about as we talk each week, Ed, those are trends that we see continuing.
Okay, I think you stole my thunder. I wanted to save the good news for the last thing, but let's talk about that's good. I'm glad you did that because now it leads me. Sure, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I wanted to add one more piece of thinking about for investors, and that is that the old 60-40, the new is the 65-35. So there is going to be a shift for investors as what is not good in an inflationary environment is fixed income, at least what I mean by traditional fixed income. There are areas in fixed income like TIPS, like high yield, that can still do well against inflation because of the way that those are structured. But I think we're going to see, and we're talking to investors, about looking at the 65-35, meaning 65% equity, 35% fixed income, as the new old 60-40 model.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about just moments after you and I spoke last week, the job numbers came out, and economists had estimated that about 975,000 new jobs would be created in April. But the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported there were just 266,000 jobs. What happened?
Well, it is a disappointing jobs number, and I think that there's a lot of things going into this. Part of it is the ongoing money that is going into the economy towards unemployment benefits. And so when you continue to give people unemployment benefits, there is not as much of an incentive for people to go back to work. That's a real, we've had a structural change in America with this idea of government income to the individual. And not only are we hearing about it at the federal level, you've heard Gavin Newsom's proposal at the state level, sending 75% of Californians checks. So this idea of staying home and collecting money is going to continue to rock the employment figures until we can wean people off of unemployment benefits. And of course, there's still a lot of fear from people as far as, can I go back to work safely? So part of that is in the mix as well. And then people wanting to be paid more for their work, and people saying, well, I'm not willing to go back to work for that amount of money. So there's a lot of factors that are going into the numbers. But if we look at jobs that need to be filled, there are manufacturing jobs that need to be filled where people can't find workers to fill them. So we need to get that structural imbalance back to work, and part of it is going to be weaning people off of unemployment.
Let me ask you this, though. If you're making more in unemployment than you are if you would go back to a job, what does that say about wages in America? Go ahead.
Yeah. So don't forget, we had unemployment, and then we had bonuses to unemployment. So it was with the bonus to the unemployment, the extra money to unemployment benefits, that was really incenting people to stay. Unemployment itself, when people look at the choice, it goes back to the whole idea of the welfare state. You know, when people had too much incentive not to work, you will have a part of the population that says, I'm just not going to work.
A very small part. So, really?
We can argue about that, definitely, but I believe it's a substantial part. But let me get back to another. Okay. There was another release this week that was very positive, and that was around our NFIB Small Business Index. So the NFIB is a survey of small business owners, and it has to do with their optimism about the business environment. And it went from 98.2 to 99.8. So what that tells us is small business owners are very confident going forward about the economy.
Okay. And we've often spoken, you and I, about the fact that if we sat around a table and just had a conversation for 2 hours, we could solve the entire world's problems. I do want to ask you this, though, because we've been talking about it all week here on the show, that for the last 12 years, the minimum wage has been at $7.50. What should the minimum wage be?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and it is a big policy question. The hard thing is, when you come from it on the West Coast, it's a very different number than it might be in rural America somewhere in the Midwest. So, you know, that is a difficult question, Ed, and I don't have an immediate answer for you. But certainly there needs, you know, minimum wage is an important part of a safety net that needs to be there. Just like we have Social Security benefits that's a safety net. We have unemployment that's a safety net. And I would put minimum wage as part of that safety net to ensure that workers are protected and not abused in the system. And so what that number actually needs to be, I don't know, but I definitely believe that we need to have a minimum wage.
Okay. Lorene Gilbert, thank you for explaining the jump in inflation and the Colonial Pipeline hack, and thank you for explaining the job numbers to us and what investors should be thinking about moving forward. How can we find you?
WealthWiseFinancial.com or 949-748-1177.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Lorene Gilbert, the award-winning president and CEO of WealthWise Financial Services and the WealthWise Moment. Thank you so much, Lorene.
Thank you, Ed. Have a great week.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.